You're listening to Psych Talk.
This is your host, Jose Dras Lopez, and we have an awesome show today about memory, morality, and how those ideas tie in with the experimental philosophy that our guest has done. And I'm going to tell you who this awesome guest is. He's Dr. Felipe de Brigard, or Felipe de Brigard. I'm going to stick with the Americanization. So he recently received his PhD in philosophy from UNC Chapel Hill, where he also conducted research at the Cognitive Neuroscience of Memory Lab of Dr. Kelly Giovanello. He's heading on to postdoctorate work at the Schachter Memory Lab at Harvard, and so we're pretty lucky here at Psych Talk to actually catch him 10 days before he catches his flight or goes on a road trip. I'll ask him about that. And he works in philosophy of mind with an emphasis in cognitive psychology and neuroscience. His research focuses on the nature of memory and its relations to other cognitive faculties, in particular perception, imagination, attention, and consciousness. He's co-written a Spanish book entitled Clinical and Cognitive Neuropsychology, and his research papers, book chapters, and commentaries in English and Spanish have appeared in many publications, including the Journal of Consciousness Studies and the Journal Philosophical Psychology. So, Felipe, it's great to have you on. You want to say hi?
Yep, thanks for inviting me.
Let's start with the memory component. Tell me a little bit about, I know one of your studies was about what you call like counterfactual episodic memory. Tell us a little bit about that study or any other studies you've done and how those work, like what steps are involved.
I have always been very interested on memory. In fact, when I was an undergrad, most of my studies in neuropsychology had to do with Alzheimer's disease and had to do with pathologies related to memory and aging. So I was very, very interested on that. In fact, when I was finishing college, I thought of becoming a clinical psychologist, and I realized that I really did not wanted to work in the clinical aspect. I wanted to work in the theoretical aspect. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, I have always been very interested in memory, and in particular, I have been very interested on why memory is so incredibly unreliable. Mm-hmm. We have all sorts of memories of things that we think happened but didn't, but when we experience them, they present to us as though they had actually happened.
Yeah.
And I always thought that maybe the explanation as to why that happened did not involve any sort of malfunctioning of memory. So when I started, you know, doing some research on memory, I came across the writings of two very influential people in my life, I guess authors in my life. One is Bartlett, B.F. Bartlett, the psychologist, who wrote a very important book, relatively underappreciated, but I think that is becoming more and more appreciated these days, called Remembering. He was a social psychologist, and this is a particular interesting aspect of the history of memory. He was a Cambridge professor, and he was a social psychologist who was not so interested in the quantitative aspects of research. So if you read Remembering, you would go like, really? Am I reading a psychologist? There is no p-values. Where are the values? Where are the averages?
Well, did he do experiments?
He did experiments.
Okay.
But he was much more interested in the qualitative aspects of the descriptions of the experiments. Mm-hmm. And he has a very famous experiment that you probably have come across. He presented a story about ghosts in a war with Indians and so forth. It's not, the narrative of the story is not incredibly clear to many readers or many listeners of the story. And he presented the story to many different cultures and different groups of people. It was a very short story. And then he asked them to recast the story, retell the story to him. And what he was interested in was the fact that every person from a different culture would sort of put a different frame to different framework to that particular story, and they will retell it in a particular way, as though they were filling in the gaps of a particular, as he called it, a gist of the story, and right. Then everyone will feel, according to their own idiosyncrasy, they will fill in the gaps. So he thought that memory had a reconstructive character to it. When you remember something, you piece together a specific experience from things that you have experienced in the past, but you're, as it were, you fill in as it goes, as you're remembering.
Right. And what you fill in depends on your background and culture.
He was very interested in the background and culture, and that's the sociological or social aspect of it. Mm-hmm. The cognitive aspect of that filling in came, I think, with the work of Daniel Schachter. He, in the starting in the 90s probably, he started to think about memory as being this reconstructive process, and he was very interested in the computational processes that would help filling those gaps as we reconstruct. And I thought that made a lot of sense. But then it put in question as to, you know, we have the idea that memory is, in a sense, a reproductive faculty. Like you experience something, you store it, and remembering is only to reproduce that which we experienced.
Right, just past. Like pulling out of a box.
As it were. We have that idea since Plato, if you want. Mm-hmm. But this kind of research puts that idea of memory as being reproductive into question. It's more like reconstructed. And reconstruction usually means that there is some lack of fidelity in the way in which we reconstruct our memories. But then the question is, why does that happen? And is this a good thing or a bad thing? Mm-hmm. So I've saw some connection between this specific aspect of reconstruction and some research that that Dr. Schachter, along with Donna Addis, have been doing, which has to do with the recent discovery that the same brain regions that are active or that are required for remembering the past are also required for thinking about the future. Hmm. So I think that one of the first observations that happened came from Endel Tolving at the beginning of the 1980s, where he asked some amnestic patients, patients that have amnesia, to remember the past. And we all know that they are pretty bad at remembering the past.
That's by definition,
pretty much. Amnesia. But it's very surprising that they are also very bad about thinking about what might happen in the future. Hmm. So there was that was an observation that was done sort of on passing. So, well, we have a battery of tests. Why don't we test them about the future thinking?
Right.
But since the beginning of the 2000s, there started to be a lot of research done both in
amnesiacs
and people with different different pathologies that affect memory. Mm-hmm. And it's very consistent that they are also really bad about thinking about what might happen in the future. So it occurred to me that there is a component to thinking about what might happen in the future that pertains to likelihood of events ever happening. Mm-hmm. What about if we extend that likelihood of event ever happening in the future to the possibility of events that could have happened in the past but mm-hmm. didn't? And that's what my research is about, is trying to understand if the same mechanisms by means of which we think about what happened in the past and what might happen in the future are also involved in thinking about what might have happened in the past. And we call that episodic counterfactual thinking.
Hmm. So episodic memory, let's talk about what that is and what that isn't. So good. What it wouldn't be is like procedural memory, like how to do certain things, like cook a certain dish or ride a bike, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's also a little different from knowing facts, right? Like Paris, the capital of France, triangle has three sides. Mm-hmm. So really talking about memories of events that happened in people's lives.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. in cognitive science, usually, in order to be able to speak about different cognitive systems, mm-hmm. you usually make use of this notion of double dissociation. Mm-hmm. By double dissociation, what I mean is that you can have a specific cognitive system that can work and do its operations in absence of a different cognitive system. So just mm-hmm. to give you an example, suppose that you have these very old televisions. I had a television like this when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the visual image will go off. And the sound will still be working, and vice versa. Sometimes you have the sound that was not working and then the image was still working.
Yeah.
What that tells you is that they are doubly dissociable, because you can have image without sound and sound without image. And you know, because there is the behavior of the television, that the image and the sound are operated by different cognitive systems or by different systems.
Right.
Likewise for memory or for any cognitive systems.
So memory is not one thing. It has
memory is not one thing. It has different things. So we know from dissociations in patients as well as experimental dissociations that people, for instance, that have difficulty remembering events that happened to them in the past mm-hmm. can nonetheless still remember semantic facts, as you were saying, what the capital of Venezuela is and so on.
Right.
Likewise, we know that when people have these kinds of memories altered, they nonetheless can still be able to remember how to ride a bike. So these different kinds of memories, like all combined, say, we generally call memory, but they are different subsystems. And right. I am very interested specifically on autobiographical episodic memory.
Okay. And those are similar terms, right? Autobiographical, episodic.
Well, there is some discussion. I mean, autobiographical refers to information about our life. So, for instance, knowing when my birthday is probably semantic. So, so some people might suggest that autobiographical memory involves also semantic memory.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I like to say that I am interested in specific episodic memories that are also autobiographical.
Right, right. One thing I also want to cover is you mentioned amnesics, and they're neurological case studies that give us these surprising insights. Just for the benefit of our listeners, what would be an example of why someone would be amnesic? Like they have damage to a particular part of their brain, I guess?
Yes, they do. There are obviously different etiologies, that is different causes for amnesia. So a very famous case, HM, was a patient that he was... he had epilepsy and he had like terrible seizures, and so as a result, Dr. Scoville in 1957, I believe, he underwent some surgery, and Dr. Scoville removed part of it, of the mediatemporal lobe. So we know that in general, or not in general, like always, every time that you have an accident that affects the hippocampus and surrounding regions in the mediatemporal lobes, you're going to develop some sort of memory problem. You're going to be unable to encode new memories, and depending on the extent of the lesion, you might not be able to retrieve memories that have already been stored.
Mm-hmm. And that's that medial temporal lobe sitting between the ears, right, and the hippocampus is the little, like, seahorse thing.
And that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Or I guess there are two of them, right? One on both sides.
Well, they are
two pieces.
Pieces of it. Since they're medial, then, like, right next to each other.
Oh, okay.
They're basically, mirror images of it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay, so that's where our memory is. That's what you don't want to damage if you...
You don't want to damage. There is probably vascularization goes like right above the hippocampus. So when there is problems with oxygen, like getting onto your brain, it's likely that you might have some memory damage because problems with oxygen. So it's in a risky place. You have to exercise a lot so you won't have problems with that.
Yeah. I mean, and sometimes it's inevitable if you get Alzheimer's, those areas are going to be hit by clocks.
It looks as though the progression of Alzheimer's it starts off precisely in the mediatemporal lobe, and it starts spreading more dorsally and then more frontally, but that's why usually the first complaint of people that are on to develop Alzheimer's disease is memory, because usually a pathology starts kind of like around that area.
Okay. Well, we've got this problem we set up for ourselves. If memory isn't quite what it seems, and somehow memory is connected to predicting the future, and you've started testing this, let's convince our listeners that memory does malfunction enough to warrant this sort of explanation, and tell us why you might disagree with other explanations people have about why memory malfunctions. And maybe, it doesn't happen often enough. Our brain's just not efficient sometimes because it has constraints, or that we can remember things when we really need to in some contexts. So talk a little bit about how your hypothesis has become more of a theory as you've added some evidence to it.
Good. So, I wouldn't say so much that is my theory as much as it is cobbled from a lot of people. So I have many influences. Bartlett, one of them. Schachter being another one of my influences. Mm-hmm. But there is another interesting influence to this view. William James.
William James.
William James, not so much in his chapter about memory, but in his chapter about attention. As you might know, when James was asked to write The Principles of Psychology, he was like doing a lot of reading, like a good person who's writing a textbook is supposed to do, and he was doing a lot of reading, and apparently he also received lots of letters, and people were asking him, how can I improve my memory, which is something that I constantly hear also. I have a terrible memory, and people say, just study memory, you should have a good memory, and I don't. And likewise, I think happened with William James, which, by the way, was also a philosopher. And James said, I don't think that the question about improving your memory has to do with memory, but actually has to do with attention. Do you want to be able to remember more? Pay better attention. So here is a good example. Sometimes we forget where we leave our keys. I don't think that that's a problem with memory. I think that that has to do with our attention. Part of a problem of multitasking is that we're paying attention to many things at the same time. As a result, we have less resources allocated to a particular specific task. With less resources allocated to a particular specific task, there is less chance of that information getting encoded.
Yeah.
attention, I think, is required for encoding information that is later on to be retrieved in episodic or declarative memory.
Mm-hmm.
So if attention is what gates information that is going to be encoded, then attention plays a significant role in what are the mental representations that later on is more likely that we're going to be able to retrieve.
Right.
So the more attention you pay to a particular task, the more likely is that the particular mental representations that you get stored when you're experiencing whatever you're experiencing are going to be retrieved. But if you don't pay attention, then you need a system that is reliable enough to fill in the gaps for that which attention did not filter in.
Okay.
Right? So my thought is we have developed a system that is reliable enough to fill the information. Not if it doesn't have it because you did not pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't have it, with the most optimal filling in to cover that particular gap when you're remembering.
And you're saying most optimal, like in evolutionary sense, like this is filling in that helps us have babies. Basically.
That's a question that I haven't been able to answer yet.
Okay.
There are at least two possibilities.
Okay.
One possibility is that what is more optimal is what our previous experience led us, let's say, in Bayesian terms, to be the most probable way of filling out that information.
Yeah.
Another possibility is that it has nothing to do with experience. You can have, say, lots and lots of experiences with ostriches when you think about birds, but okay. Nonetheless, because the more archetypical bird is a robin, the next time that you try to remember a particular bird is less likely that you remember an ostrich than it is that you remember a robin. The same sort of problems occur in the concepts literature. And there are days in which I think maybe a frequentist story like the ostrich might work, maybe a more prototypical story like the robin might work.
Okay.
I'm not completely sure. I think that the evidence that we have so far does not speak in favor of one or another theory, but give me a couple of years.
Okay, yeah, well, we'll check back. I'll drag you back down here to Chapel Hill. But both of those stories have to do with responding to the environment and storing experiences and using those experiences somehow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's memory. I was curious, it was interesting you mentioned William James and how he said, well, pay attention. So if you did have to give advice to people who wanted to improve their memory, it would be something about like training your attention or meditating to do that or who knows?
I don't know. The first thing that I would mention is when your memory fails in the sense that you don't seem to remember something exactly as it happened, mm-hmm. or when you feel information, for instance, one of my favorite phenomena is what is called the observer perspective in memory. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I don't know if this has happened to you, sometimes you remember things from a perspective other than the perspective from which you experience a particular event.
Yeah.
That happens to almost everybody. And it is a very normal thing that memory does. So when those sorts of very ordinary phenomena occur, don't think that your memory is malfunctioning. I think that your memory is doing exactly what it is supposed to do. We live in a world that it is filled with information. We cannot pay attention to absolutely everything that is going around us. So it is a good thing that we have a system that reliable gives us, you know, the most optimal representation that there could be whenever we're trying to remember a particular past experience.
Mm-hmm.
So my first advice is not to be terribly concerned about ordinary malfunctions of memory. If you feel that ordinarily your memory seems to be malfunctioning, then maybe you want to start being concerned about. I think that the attention thing that William James advised us is still good these days.
Right.
Pay better attention and try to focus your mind on one specific or two specific things. I don't think that multitasking is particularly good for encoding. Mm-hmm. It might be good for other reasons, but it might not be particularly good for encoding.
Yeah.
And honestly, exercise, you need to keep
and
that
sleep, I guess.
And sleep probably before consolidation. You need your hippocampus to be, you know, full with oxygen.
good. So basically the takeaway is memory is not quite for remembering, but I don't want to get too extreme, and I want to make sure we buffer the other side. Like memory also has some fidelity to it. Like
yeah,
you still need to be able to find your car keys.
Oh, sometimes. Absolutely. Absolutely. It is not only for remembering. It is for other things. So So I don't think that memory evolved to be reproductive. So if you think that remembering consists in the reproduction of previous experiences, I think you're wrong. Mm-hmm. If you think that remembering consists in a very the most optimal representation of a previous experience, even though that might include a little bit of lack of fidelity, mm-hmm. I think that is right. And what you're doing is you're using the reason why that happened is because the very same mechanism that allows you to think about what happened in the past with as much fidelity as possible, given this filling in information, also allows you to do other things. For instance, think about the future or think about what could have happened in the past but didn't.
Right.
So memory is part of a larger system that actually allows you to predict what might happen in the future. And there's a lot of debate these days on this idea. Moshe Bar, a professor at Harvard, has been particularly vocal about it, that the brain is a predictor. The mm-hmm. brain is a machine that predicts. So, and I like that idea quite a bit. And I think that if you have a memory that it was incredibly faithful to what was going on before, and to the extent that it would never have these distortions and so on, it might be possible that you will be losing some of this predictability. Mm-hmm. And I think that the brain capitalizes on the very same mechanisms by means of which we remember, by filling in, you know, recombining the sensory components. And they said, like, well, you get fidelity enough, let's use this for thinking about the future and for thinking about alternative ways in which the past could have been.
That's clever. Well, the brain's a predictor. I want to throw out the possibility that the brain's also maybe an influencer or a shaper of the environment. And specifically in comparing this idea of memory as a predictive process to a theory I know you don't think is quite as rigorous, which is the argumentative theory of reasoning that's been taking shape, I guess, in the last decade. And there was a big paper about it recently from Dan Sperber and Hugo Mercier. Mm-hmm. And they basically say that one very important function of our ability to reason is to argue with other people and to maneuver in society, to convince people of our point of view so that we can get some benefit from it. And that this explains, just like in memory, there are distortions like the observer effect you mentioned. People have biases that are self-serving, all kinds of things. Well, in reasoning, there are also biases, especially like confirmation bias, where people amass evidence for their initial belief. So there's similar distortions and biases. And so there's a similar need to explain why we're really good at reasoning sometimes and bad at reasoning other times. Just like sometimes our memory seems really good, sometimes it seems really bad. So I see some parallels. But I'm curious, I want you to take apart how these ideas are different and maybe just speculate a little bit with me.
Yeah, I think that Sperber's view and Mercier's view is very attractive. I mm-hmm. I enjoyed reading the paper in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, mm-hmm. and I think, I mean, you finished reading the paper and said, this is amazing. There is so much data that it seems to be explainable according to this particular view.
Yeah,
most of the data is the data that comes from social psychology.
Okay,
and I have a little bit of a harder time trying to anchor some of these results into a more biological story. So I think that evolutionary explanations are like they walk in this very narrow path in which you have to be both very consistent with the biological mechanisms that will give rise to this specific story, specific cognitive explanation, but at the same time, it needs to make sense of the environment in which we live. And when we talk about humans, we usually talk about social environments as well. So I feel that the Sperber and Mercier story is amazing in the second time. Like, that is to say, it makes a lot of sense in the social environment in which we live. But sometimes I have a harder time understanding how it could be anchored in more biologically, like, driven mechanisms. That doesn't mean that the data is not there to try to anchor that. I just don't know that data.
Okay.
However, it's a fantastic hypothesis to keep on pursuing experiments and to try to figure out how other cognitive faculties might relate to it. Now, in the case of memory, there is something that is interesting. Even though I believe that memory did not evolve to be incredibly faithful or reproductive as a faculty, and that actually has some other functions. We still believe, or many philosophers at least still believe, that memory can only be about what that which happened in the past. And if there's all the discussions about what the difference between memory and imagination is.
Yeah.
And one possibility is that the reason why we insist so much that memory is only about what happened in the past is that there are sociological or social constraints, if you want, to what we are supposed to remember. There are some evidence, for instance, that in certain cultures you're not supposed to use the term remember or memory unless you're also willing to tell what's the source of your certainty. So, and that's very interesting because that really puts the bar as to what remembering consists in very, very high, much higher than, say, we have it in English or in Spanish. So it might be possible that there are sociological or at least social reasons for keeping our memory practices up to a certain standard, even if psychologically our standards are much lower. So I think that there are interesting parallels, and as a result, that there are, I think, interesting avenues for future research.
And let me just make sure I digested what you're saying. Society has wants fidelity, and some societies will embed in their language these high standards of fidelity, even though it contradicts what memory is usually doing. Something like
one that. Thing that is very interesting about memory and the terms remembering and is that there is a lot of variability across different languages. So just as there is this is a culture and I believe it's an Aboriginal culture in Mexico. They have these very high standards for the use of terms like remembering. There are other cultures like some Aborigines in Australia, and I am just basically quoting from a book that is only about different terms of remembering. there are different cultures in Australia that do not have a term whatsoever for remembering. They do away with perceiving and with temporal with temporal terms, but they don't have a term for remembering. So there is a lot of variability when it comes to just languages as to what how to talk about past experiences. So I think that there is a lot of maneuvering at the social level to try to figure out how much of our own ways of understanding memory are constrained by our societal practices and how much of that is just constrained by the biology of our psychology.
Well, it sounds like fertile ground. When I do drag you back, we'll talk about that more. So for listeners who just turned it on the car, this is Psych Talk, and we're speaking with Dr. Felipe de Brigard. He recently got his PhD in philosophy from UNC Chapel Hill. He's heading over to the Schachter Memory Lab at Harvard, and we just talked a bit about how memory is not just for remembering. Now we're going to move a bit to some of Felipe's other work, and I'll start with one issue you've talked about, which is we were talking about how there are different ways of talking about remembering. Well, there are also different ways, especially in like folk psychology and just everyday life, that people talk about attention and consciousness, and sometimes people don't distinguish between them. And you had one paper that had an interesting survey trying to figure out what people think about a baby waking up a mother in the night and whether that means that she was like paying attention to it while she was sleeping or that she became conscious of it. And if you could tell us a little bit about that and how it ties into these broader questions about our awareness, our consciousness, our attention.
I'm also interested in issues having to, as you mentioned, attention and consciousness. Mm-hmm. But one thing that is interesting is that the more philosophy I learn, I guess, the more careful I want to be with the science that I do. And one way of being careful with the science is being careful with the operationalization of your terms. Mm-hmm. Unlike many philosophers, I don't believe that we get a whole lot of insight by only doing conceptual analysis and our pre-theoretical terms that we use for psychology. But along with many philosophers, I do believe that conceptual analysis is required for having a better understanding of the things, the phenomena that we're studying.
Yeah.
I just think that the conceptual analysis should be deployed within the context of scientific research. So the issue of attention and consciousness interested me basically at the beginning of my PhD. I wasn't particularly interested in consciousness, which is strange given that I'm a philosopher, and usually philosophers that are empirically oriented are very interested in consciousness. And I thought that consciousness is kind of a cool problem, but I don't think that it is that difficult.
Really? Are we talking about the same consciousness?
I think we are talking about the same consciousness.
Just the idea of like why we... Oh, well, you came from Dan Dennett. I know why.
That's also true. But I don't think that it is terribly interesting in the sense that I think that a lot of very important work on consciousness has already been done. And my feeling is that many of the questions about consciousness that we think are so untractable today are going to get much easier once we know more about other cognitive faculties, in particular attention, working memory, long-term memory, and perception. Mm-hmm. And I feel that some of the questions that surround consciousness are starting to be dissolved because we have a much better understanding of other cognitive faculties. Mm-hmm. So when I started thinking about other cognitive faculties like attention and working memory, it started to become clear to me that there are certain phenomena that I thought was proprietary of consciousness that actually was better understood in terms of attention or working memory and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's why I mean that it is not that terribly interesting. I think it's interesting because because consciousness is this amalgam of things that involve memory and attention, which are cognitive faculties that I think are particularly interesting. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying consciousness is like this sort of squishy concept describing our experience and this small slice of what's happening in our brain, but they're different processes that are underlying it that are more interesting to get the problem with.
Part of the problem is that precisely at the folk psychological level, the terms that we use for, say, attention and remembering and consciousness, they don't mirror the way in which the brain and actually the way in which our cognitive system operates.
Okay.
So we parcel psychological faculties at the folk psychological level in a way that is different from the way in which our biology parceled our cognitive faculties. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a phenomenal question. Is why is it... So think about the issue of memory. I don't think that memory is exactly for remembering in the way in which folk psychologically we think that mm-hmm. remembering is for. We think... I think that the brain evolved a system by means of which we remember that is does not exactly square with the way in which we think memory works at the folk psychological level.
Yeah.
I think that the same goes on with attention and consciousness. But at the beginning of my PhD program, I took this class on attention, and I was also interested in the issue of consciousness. And so I started reading a bunch of people working on the intersection between attention and consciousness. And I realized that there were some people, you know, that said that attention was necessary and sufficient for consciousness. And so other people said, no, attention might be necessary but not sufficient. Attention might be sufficient but not necessary or neither.
Yeah.
So they're all the... And then I started to think, well, it's very interesting because they all seem to operationalize both terms, both the attention term and the consciousness term, in ways that favor their own interpretations of their data.
Of course.
So what I ended up doing in my final paper was for that class was, well, let me take a bunch of these experiments that these people interpret as giving evidence, say, for attention not being necessary for consciousness, mm-hmm. and let me operationalize these notions of attention and consciousness in a way that is not congenial with their interpretation, but it is congenial with the interpretation of other data. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that this very experiment that someone used to try to demonstrate that you could have attention without consciousness with a different interpretation was a very good experiment to show that you could not have consciousness unless you're attending to it. So what it turned out is that it was underdetermined, as it were, by the data. And that's my philosophical mind at that point flagged this kind of thing as something that requires some conceptual analysis.
Right.
You need to do some cleaning up of your concepts before you can say that any data is actually giving you evidence in favor or against some particular view. Mm-hmm. And even though I don't do a specific experiments on attention and consciousness, I try to be a good philosopher of neuroscience and try to do some cleaning up.
Well, one thread in our discussion today has been how different disciplines collide. Mostly we talked about experimental disciplines in psychology and philosophy, which doesn't necessarily involve experiment. But then with the question of attention and consciousness, there's almost a linguistic question too of how people learn different terms and how people come to use them and what unconscious associations people have when you tweak the wording in a survey. So then it's just a reminder that whenever you're studying the mind, you really have to be keeping all these variables in mind. You have to try to be some kind of savant and work in teams if possible. Okay, so that's attention and consciousness. Let's look at another somewhat related aspect of what we're calling folk psychology. Mm-hmm. In other words, what people tend to believe about their own minds without really studying psychology or studying the brain. And that is free will and whether people's free will relates to their moral responsibility. And there's been a lot of research on this, and you've added by looking at different cultures and whether this people's general belief that we can choose our actions, that there's not fully determined by something else, if that's universal. And then there's an interesting aspect of whether people are thinking about something concrete or in the abstract. It seems like in the abstract, people think, oh, if you don't have free will, you can't blame a terrible criminal. But then when people read a story of a real terrible criminal, they say, oh, he's fully responsible for what he did, even though he lives in this imagined universe where everything's caused. So there's some interesting tensions. Just tell me about what you found, and then we can trace those implications a little bit more.
So that's a lot of things. The cross-cultural work, I was actually just collaborating in this study was primarily conducted by Hagop Sarkisian, which is a professor at CUNY. Hagop had the idea that building up on previous research that had suggested that that people were actually compatibilist, and by compatibilism is the view according to which determinism, that is to say, the claim that every event was completely determined by the event that happened previously, and moral responsibility are compatible. Many philosophers argue that they are incompatible. You cannot be free unless you could have done otherwise. And so if determinism is true, then you could not have done otherwise,
right,
which de facto undermines responsibility.
This is sort of a subtle point, because it's not that you couldn't have thought about doing something else or that you didn't consider something else, but just that determinism says that because of the state of the universe before your choice, that even if you thought about it, there's only one thing that could happen.
That
right?
could have happened, exactly. Yeah. So the idea is that if determinism is true, then there is no room for you to have done otherwise, and you cannot be blamed for something that you could not have done otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So the claim is that free will and moral responsibility are just, that determinism and moral responsibility is just basically incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
And what this previous research seemed to suggest is that people are actually compatibilist. They are very happy with the idea that you should be held responsible for an action, even if you could not have done otherwise.
Okay.
So Hagop had this intuition that they might extend beyond the limits of the American undergraduates.
Yeah.
So we conducted it in other countries. But that being said, I'm not entirely sure that the data necessarily suggests that people are actually compatibilist. I believe that judgments of responsibility, and again, I don't think that is terribly original, what I am going to say, Aristotle thought that too, are particularly difficult. And I think that when people judge responsibility, there is a huge amount of things that are going on. And these studies, even though they are very interesting, they are not very well controlled. So you're not exactly clear as to what exactly is going on in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
To put it in slightly more technical terms, but when experimental philosophers are conducting these vignette sort of studies, they are manipulating what the participant is reading, not what the participant is thinking. They're
right.
hoping that what the participant think somehow reflects what they read.
Yeah.
But there is the lack of control speaks very little to whether they're actually manipulating that or not. So there's a lot of stuff that might be going on. And I believe that when people judge a person that couldn't have done otherwise,
mm-hmm.
As being responsible for what he or she did, there are other considerations that come into play.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just give you an example. Suppose that your neighbor is a child molester, and you have a young girl, and the doctor suggests that, you know, they go on to undo this experiment. Turns out that he has a terrible brain tumor in a region of the brain that prevents certain reflexes or certain inhibition.
And something like this has happened before.
Yeah, it has happened before. So obviously you have the gut reaction to say, well, he might not be responsible for doing it because, well, his brain made him do it or something along those lines. But still, there are other reasons why you might want to hold that person responsible, even if that those are unfair reasons. You have a little girl, and this guy lives next to you. So maybe you are considering things that might happen in the future if the person is or is not held responsible now. And in fact, right now, with one of my ex-students, who's now a graduate student in Georgia State, we conducted a series of experiments in which we showed that you can have difference or asymmetries in judgments of responsibility on the basis of what people think might happen in the future if an agent is held or is not held responsible now. So what I'm suggesting with this is, responsibility is a very difficult issue. That's why we have lawyers, probably. It's a very difficult issue. And when people think about responsibility, even when they think about determinism or free will and things like that, there are lots of considerations that get into play. And it is very difficult to tease them apart. Some of them might not be fair. I don't think that it is fair to say that a person should be held responsible for something that he or she could not have done on the basis that I have a little daughter and I don't want her.
Are you a determinist in the sense that you think, you know, it doesn't matter if there's a tumor. It just, the person has a brain, that brain is a machine, and therefore we should like think of everyone as in some sense reacting to the world as if they had Tourette's? Or you haven't gone that far yet?
I haven't gone that far yet. I am a determinist of a very low level of description. I do believe that there is causality and that causality is, you know, by necessity and so on. But I do believe that the psychological level, the way in which we talk about responsibility and other psychological terms, is a much higher level of description. Mm-hmm. Again, as you mentioned before, I'm the student of Dennett, so I might not be that terribly interested in unconsciousness, but I am definitely interested in his view about free will. And I like the idea that there are differences in the levels of description at the intentional versus the biological or the functional level. Mm-hmm. So I think that something along those lines is going on. It's kind of like a category mistake, if you want. I think that there are important questions as to whether neuroscience is should change the way in which we consider people being responsible or not.
Yeah.
But neuroscience per se is mute. They won't say whether a person is responsible or not. You can describe the behavior. Neuroscientists can describe the behavior of what is going on. But I don't think that neither neuroscience is going to change the way in which our legal practices or our attributions of responsibility work. And I don't think that they also are going to change the way in which people folk psychologically attribute responsibility. Why? Mm-hmm. Because responsibility, again, is a very complex concept and it's a very complex kind of train of thought. So even if you have evidence to the fact that this person should not have done otherwise, that's just one of the many factors that influences people's judgments of responsibility. So it might impinge a little bit on the judgments of responsibility, but I don't think that evidence, neuropsychological evidence or neurological evidence, is going to swap, completely change the people's views on responsibility.
Oh, well, I was hoping the world would get overturned. I think it sounds like you're right. We're going to have to wrap up now. I'd talk all day if we could. But thank you so much for coming on. Again, our guest was Dr. Felipe de Brigard, a PhD in philosophy from UNC Chapel Hill. And he's talked to us about all kinds of things. It's been great having you on.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. We'll be right back.